My name is Hussein Alizadeh. I'm the Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. I've been with Eagle Heart for the past 4.5 years. And I started working here as the Communications Coordinator, also focusing on two countries in the Middle East and North Africa, Iran and Iraq, basically, because of the crisis there. And in 2009, we decided to start an independent Middle East and North Africa program. And we decided that I would be the dedicated full-time staff, basically, working on that project.
What is the mandate of this organization? What is it working for or against?
When Eagle Heart started its work 21 years ago, it was basically in order to be a voice for LGBT. Basically, at that point, there was no human rights organization, mainstream human rights organization, that was working on LGBT rights violations. Based on what I heard from the founder of the organization, when she started working as an activist, she was a college student. She heard about human rights violations, arrests actually of gay people in Russia. And she wrote to Amnesty International asking them to support the people who are detained. And they told her, well, that's not really what we do. We don't work on the LGBT issue. That's not really our focus. So she got so angry that at that young age, as a college student, in her own kitchen, she started a movement that was called Little Eagle Heart. So she wanted to basically draw attention to violations of rights of people on a daily basis because of their gender identity or sexual orientation. And ever since then, we've been trying to basically keep that focus. Now the work has changed because now, thankfully, there are so many organizations, some of the mainstream, that work on LGBT rights situation. We have Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they all have their own dedicated LGBT programs, but also many, many groups, both nationally and internationally, that do the same work. And so we decided to pick a niche that is more relevant and needed. And so we do a lot of international advocacy and coordinations between regional work and national work. So that's what we are focusing on right now.
What is the ideological foundation of the organization, if you can expose that?
Well, I don't think it is mainly ideological. It was basically a concept that it's still our name tag. It says human rights for everyone, everywhere. And the idea is as simple as that. We're not asking for specific rights or privileges for LGBT people. What we're asking is that when you have citizens in a country that are entitled to rights, those rights are for everybody. Regardless of whether they are straight or gay, or whether they are lesbians or, you know, heterosexual, it's just universal.
How do you implement this project? Is it mostly advocacy and lobbying, or do you develop specific socially based community projects in different places?
So we decided very early on that because of our location and because of our position as a US-based organization, we don't want to go to different countries, sort of parachute there and tell people what to do. There needs to be dynamic and organic conversation happening on the country level, and the local activists should decide how they want to proceed. What we do is that we support them. Sometimes the support can be something as easy as connecting them with the funders. Sometimes they need international visibility. They want somebody to basically spread their press releases. Sometimes it can be as easy as writing a letter to the government. Sometimes it can be through trainings and workshops, or through bringing them to the United Nations and different mechanisms within the United Nations. The main issue is that we do not try to impose our judgment on countries. So if activists are not ready or willing to take the strategy that we feel is the best, we don't impose it on them. We try to negotiate and work with them basically to come up with a solution that is meaningful for them.
So oftentimes it is thought of as international organizations are promoting an international LGBTQ agenda.
Right.
That doesn't really necessarily relate to local situations.
Well, right? we are very conscious of that. I mean, it is the sad reality that the West has the money and the loud voice, and we don't want to be this obnoxious US-based group that goes around and tell people what to do. We realize that in most cases there is a great deal of sensitivity about Western-based organizations, and B, about an LGBT group that is operating outside the territory. So there are many, many considerations that we have to be mindful of. And so when we work, we try to take into consideration the sensitivities of the locals and the strategy that may not make sense to the Western audience, but it is effective within those countries.
Earlier on, you mentioned that the focus of your work is in the Middle East and North Africa, and in particular Iran and Iraq, and you mentioned that there was a crisis. Can you expose what this crisis is and how you're approaching it?
Right. Unfortunately, this is an ongoing situation, and it's only getting worse. The problem in each country in the Middle East is slightly different from the other, but the foundation of that is the inherent cultural homophobia that is being fueled by religious intolerance. In both cases of Iran and Iraq, you have the deadly combination of cultural homophobia and religious intolerance. In case of Iran, it's different from Iraq because in Iran you have a government that is in charge. It is trying to impose the religious law, which classifies sex between two men as a crime punishable by death. So you have death penalty for sodomy crimes, and also a bunch of laws that being used again and again in order to intimidate, harass, and penalize the gay and lesbian community. In case of Iraq, it is different in the sense that you don't have the government that is going after gay people. You have the vigilantes, those so-called self-appointed religious forces that decide that the gays are destroying the fabrics of the society, so they take it upon themselves to go and hunt the gay people, basically. So basically, this has been going on in Iraq since 2003, the US invasion of that country. And unfortunately, the situation on the ground is very bad, because in Iraq, you don't have, it's up to the people. If you don't like your neighbor for any reason, you just go after them and accuse them of being gay. Now, who is the judge? Who's going to, you know, or if you dress up too provocatively, then they assume you are gay, whether you are or not. So it is a very tricky situation, and unfortunately, the security on the ground is not so that there is a chance for many international groups to intervene, but we try to work with activists underground, and a lot of support also for the refugees, the people who are forced to leave their country, both from Iran and Iraq, to get as much as we could to those people in need.
You are from Iran, correct?
I am Iranian, yes.
And did your leaving Iran have to do anything to do with your sexual orientation?
No, it was not related to that. I came here compared to many people whom I talked to ever since. I've been lucky, I should say, because I came here on a scholarship. I came to college here. I did my education and then I stayed on. I wasn't actively persecuted, and I want to elaborate on that in a while, but most people who are forced to leave the country, it comes to the point that they no longer can basically stay in the country. Either they are being harassed and intimidated by their own family members. There's a lot of honor killing also. If they find out you are gay, they come to kill you because they feel that you are dishonoring the entire family. Or there have been government cases that, you know, they have been persecuted by the government, either harassed, raped, you know, things like that. And so there have been a lot of cases where we had people like that living in Iran. My case have been very benign compared to them. At the moment I came here and I, you know, decided that, you know, I am who I am, I realized that it is not safe for me to go back there. But once I was in Iran, I did not face many of the problems that I have seen other people had to deal with.
What is life in Iran like in terms of being able to have to live a sexually open life? In other words, is there an underground community? Is there a space where people are gathering unofficially?
Yes and no. It's sort of funny, like most countries on the planet, you have freedom as long as you have the resources. If you have money, you can bribe the police so that they don't come and bother you. And you can have access to places that is otherwise, you know, exclusive. And that's why you have a very affluent, rather comfortable gay community in both Iran and Iraq, you know, and many countries in the region. But that is very atypical of the rest of the population. So when you're talking about the people, really, the average Joe does not have access to that. So either you're lucky and you have tons of money, therefore you can do whatever you want to do, whether you're gay or straight, or else you are a working class or, you know, middle class family, and to put it mildly, you're screwed. For the majority of people who do not belong to that high society, the only way that they can find places is, yeah, there are a couple of places that are known to be hangout of the gay people, but you do it at your own risk. You go there, the police might raid the place any minute, or even the other guy who is really gay might try to blackmail you. That's the serious problem in both countries. I've seen people started a relationship and having few romantic encounters with the person they liked, and then when things moved a little bit further, then they start receiving letters, you know, or the calls that, oh, you have to also have sex with the other guy. Why? If not, I'm going to call the police on you. Or, you know, you keep giving me money. Like, there are so many things that happen. So it is psychologically very devastating. It's like you're walking on a minefield. You never know when you're going to, you know, walk onto, you know, mine and you're going to explode. So you always have to watch out for what is ahead of you. And that anxiousness is part of the life. The other part is really that structural violence that exists. So you may not be directly persecuted by the government, but A, you know you're different. B, you know that the death penalty is out there, so anybody and everybody can use it against you. C, you are being treated as a stranger to the society because people, even your family, feels, he's not straight, you know? So you have no legal protection within the society. And on a daily basis, you get harassment, you get intimidation, you get even suggestive comments, sexually suggestive comments, but you can't do anything about it. So when we talk about oppression does not need to be in the form of death penalty. The fear of having that doomsday scenario plus the day-to-day stress that you have to go through is enough to make many people either totally give up the situation, commit suicide, or have to leave the country. And then you have, for other cases, you have people who show up in a party and then there is the police raids the party, everybody gets arrested, beaten up, tortured, this, that, or, you know, the father of your boyfriend finds out that you're gay, so now you violated their honor, so they are with a knife looking for you to kill you, so things like that. And good luck, you know, if you can get support from anybody else in the society. And so most people feel very vulnerable and helpless. On top of everything else, you have the negative propaganda by the government, the media that is controlled by the government, the religious outlets, they're all telling you that what you're doing is wrong. you're committing a crime, it's a sin, all sort of negative messages. So you have no self-confidence yourself either.
Has the situation been consistently like this in the last several decades, or has it worsened or improved in the recent time?
Well, in each country in the region is different.
In the case of Iran, it is
a sad yet interesting story. Till 1979, under the previous regime in Iran, there was really no penalty for homosexuality. So they had a relatively easier time. The government was not religious, so there was no attempt to impose religious laws. The government was trying to come across as progressive, so they really didn't care about your sexuality, do whatever you want, you know, you're free. Consumption of alcohol and having parties was also allowed, so that was not a reason for the police to raid your place. Plus, the legal system in Iran was basically written based on the Belgian legal system, with the minor difference that Persian is a gender-neutral language. So when you speak in Persian, you can talk about someone. It actually happened to me. I've been talking to one of my friends that I thought he was gay, but I wasn't sure. And he says, "Oh, I'm with somebody." Okay, who is that somebody? Oh, he's from China. And then he keeps talking. After 30 minutes of conversation, I still couldn't say if he's gay or straight because he was not referring to the gender. It was someone, you know. And it's impolite to ask the gender, of course. So that ambiguity allowed the people to use it in favor of their gay movement. So in 1977, you had the first legally recognized gay marriage anywhere on this planet in Iran, because the law said marriage is a union between two people without specifying the gender of these two people. And the court decided, well, if two men want to get married, then I guess they can, because that's the law. So you have a country where in 1977, at least on the surface, was more progressive than what it is now. So the situation changed. And I'm hoping that it will, in the future, will change for better. But for now, for the past 3 decades, the society has gone through a very rough patch, basically.
You seem to blame, for lack of a better word, the religious doctrine. Is there something in the scripture of religion that condemns homosexuality directly, or is it something that has derived from a kind of moral understanding of it and its relationship to religion?
Good question. It's a little bit of both, I would say. There are scholars that argue that the only reference in the text is about the story of Lot, you know, the Sodom and all of that, what happened. Now, this is a vague reference to homosexuality, but it's not really extended conversation. So as far as the scripture says, that's all you know. But traditionally, it was understood that what they're talking about is homosexuality. For the past 20 years, there have been a new generation of scholars that have been arguing against this theory. Some of them blandly argue that there is no penalty for homosexuals. And this is not, again, based on the Western understanding of the story. It's all theological debates that's going on. And then there are other scholars that have put into question the whole traditional understanding of the penalty for homosexuality, and they, at least I've seen two or three of them, high-ranking clergy people, that say, argue that they don't understand the issue of homosexuality, and they feel that there needs to be more studies to decide whether it's really a crime or not. So there has been some debates within the religious circles, but that debate is still in the margins, even though the people who have expressed those opinions are heavyweights. But still, the religious establishment as a whole is very traditional.
And that religious establishment uses, how do they sustain the rhetoric of homophobia? Based on the word of God?
Well, here is how it works. In Iran, the story is not about the oppression of homosexuality. It's about the oppression of sexuality. I had a professor when I was doing my undergraduate studies in Iran. He is right now the head of the Human Rights Institute in Iran. Very religious man, and his brother is the head of the judiciary, the chief justice. And he used to tell us, he said, the way I understand it, in this country, you cannot even mention sex. Anything that has to do with sex is considered to be taboo. And even though it seems that the scripture is very comfortable talking about sex, the society has become so conservative that they do not feel comfortable talking about any sort of sexual relationships. It took them 10 years to make a decision about using protection for heterosexual relationships. So things are going very slow. There is an ongoing censorship within the community, and so the issues are not openly discussed. So for heterosexual people, it's impossible to go out with their girlfriend. I remember as a teenager when I used to go out with my sister, who is only 2 years older than me. Anytime I had to go out, I had to have my ID with me, because we assumed that at any point we both would have been stopped by the morality police because they wanted to see what's the relationship between me and this girl that I'm walking with. God forbid she's not my girlfriend, you know. So there's that kind of sick mentality that everybody is trying to sleep with everybody else. And that is just the sad reality that is affecting everybody's life. So when we talk about the oppression of homosexuals, I think we need to talk about the oppression of sexuality. The fact that women in this system are also extremely oppressed. The fact that even for heterosexual people, they don't have the freedom that they deserve. So it's a bigger social problem. And I feel that we cannot isolate it just as this is only homosexuals, although homosexuals are being, you know, harshly treated, and there is no denial of that. But even heterosexuals are not free. And so there are steps that need to be taken in order to eliminate that. And so the society is moving in that direction. I've seen in the past few years especially, there's been a pressure from the bottom to talk about sexuality, to talk about, now you can talk about, you for the first time, you have those high-ranking clergymen that talk about sex life. You know, you can discuss your sexual preferences with them and sexual things. These are things that 10 years ago was unthinkable, you know. So it is a social dilemma that the entire society is struggling.
During the time of the feminist movement and again lesbian movement internationally in the West, did this have any ripples in the Middle East, and in particular in this case in Iran? Were these theories and these ideas coming there, and how were they perceived?
Very good question. I feel yes and no. Yes, because you see a lot of intellectuals. And intellectual sometimes is a very nasty word when you talk about it, and I tell you why, because intellectuals, when you talk about intellectuals, it has this connotation that these people are all Western-oriented, fluent in multiple languages, and are very disconnected from the rest of the society. So they have their own circles. I've seen in many countries, unfortunately, they have a very small group of people who speak the language of the West. The majority of the society, however, is left out. I would say the most important movements are by those who try to internalize those debates. And there have been very few people who have done that, and they have been relatively successful, but you can't then argue that this is the direct influence of the feminism movement. It is a localized version of that, and unfortunately, it is not strong enough. Still, there's a lot of copying, but what is considered in the West to be relevant is culturally irrelevant for many people in other countries. So you have to always try to translate it into a language, not only just the literal translation, but also cultural translation, in a way that people can relate to it. When you talk about women in this country, you have the freedom of choice, for example. You have the reality that women can move out of their house after 18 years of age and they can go somewhere else. In most Middle Eastern societies, even men do not have that freedom. You live with your parents as long as you're single. At the age of 20 or 30, when you get married, then you move to the next. So there is no separation, and the concept of family is very different. So when you talk about feminism, you have to translate it in a way that people can relate to that, that this is talking about them.
What is the situation of lesbian women? Is it also criminalized, or is it something that it's not talked about publicly?
That's one of those tricky questions, because yes, it is penalized, but in most countries, first of all, the penalty is much lighter for women than for men. So in the case of Iran, for example, you have death penalty for men having sex with each other. For women, it's only 100 lashes.
And having sex means having anal intercourse or any form of sexual contact?
Very, very good question, because as they said, the devil is in the details. The way that the law is written, it says that any penetration, right, you need to, in order for you to conclude that they had intercourse, there needs to be anal penetration. Now, it can be either anal penetration or what they describe as rubbing between the two legs, but it needs to be that level. And in order to prove that, you need to have four witnesses. That four witnesses is always the key, because you need to have four witnesses who can show up in the court of law and tell the judge independently that they have seen with their own eyes that this act took place. Not that two people went on in the bed together, but they actually penetrated each other. And if you only have three people that are willing to testify, or you have four people who have different testimonies, guess what happens? The witnesses will be punished, not the people, because this is a serious crime. So you can't just show up in the court and accuse your neighbor of doing that. So you have to, and the fact that it shouldn't be based on speculation, it should be based on eyewitness account. Many legal experts say that if you really want to follow this law, the law is not the problem, because the law is written in a way that's next to impossible to give the conviction, and you cannot rely on medical examiner's report or anything like that. That is not admissible in the court of law. So they say this is impossible to prove. So what are you worrying about? But the problem is the court does not follow the letter of the law. They just, I've seen cases where even there are no witnesses, or there are no, they accuse people of rape and there's no victim. Like when you do rape, the understanding is there are two people involved. You can't rape yourself, right? But that's not what the court says. Oh, you're just a rapist. Okay, I'll issue the death sentence. Then there is the age thing, that you cannot issue the death sentence on people under the age of 18. They do it anyway. Then there is the issue of whether you have been willing to do it or not. If this was a willing act, or it was you are mature, or you were, I mean, there are certain conditions that needs to be met. None of them are really followed in the legal system, and that's one of our constant criticism of the legal system, that even by their own standards, the way that they go after people is illegal. When I talk about four witnesses, the four witnesses need to be at the court of law during the hearing. You can't have the pre-trial investigations. That's not admissible in the court of law. I've seen again cases that, you know, rely on pre-trial investigation. So you have so many conditions that are in theory enforced in order to protect individuals and their privacy, but in reality the laws are being abused on a daily basis to go after people. And I've seen also people who are not gay. They are known that this guy is anything but the government wants to get rid of them, so they arrest them, they torture them so that they come and confess to being gay, so that they can get rid of them, because they know the moment that you say, oh, I'm gay, then the society starts walking away. They don't support you because of the homophobia that exists, you know? So this has been so much abused that the entire concepts become like a joke, a sad joke, unfortunately.
And in actuality, how many people are condemned to death because of sexual acts?
here is what we know. In countries like Iran, they have been doing magic with the way that their legal system works. So first of all, you don't hear anybody talking about execution of two consenting adults. There is always a rape story. And this is happening, by the way, in many other countries too. Think about it. Imagine that you are with somebody and both men are having sex or whatever, you get arrested. If you want to escape, what would be the easiest excuse that you can have? Oh, I was raped. I really didn't want to do it. So you always have the rape, but you always have to take it with a grain of salt because the system is oppressive to begin with. The second thing is that they always bring other factors that is irrelevant to the case. Like you see a lot of people being accused of drug trafficking. And we know these are not drug dealers. They have nothing to do with it. They are political activists. But that is the legitimizing of the crime, of the punishment of the crime, basically. You also have other lame excuses. Three years ago, they attacked a party that they knew it was a gay party. So the morality police attacked this party. They arrested, I would say close to 100 people were arrested. But when they went with cameras. So they thought it's going to be an orgy and they're going to film everything as evidence and they're going to execute everybody right, you know, after the thing. And they went there, all they could find is, okay, there was a party and there was some cross-dressing and a few bottles of alcohol, but that was about it. So after torturing and arresting, you know, people and keeping them in custody for a few weeks, they couldn't really come up with any legitimate excuse. So what they did was that they tried people for drinking alcohol. Unfortunately, that's the same story. It's happening right now in Bahrain. They arrested what they called a gay party. And now they're charging people with smoking pot, drinking alcohol, cross-dressing, violating morality law, all sorts of phony, baloney accusations that has nothing to do with sexuality, but everybody knows why they are being arrested. So the government tries to frame you. And so when you say how many people have been executed, you never know what the exact charges are. What you know is that the government goes after them because they are gay, but you don't know what the exact charges are going to be. And the worst part is that most of these people do not have access to lawyers during the trial, or they have access to lawyers that are not willing to work on these cases, so they're pro bono lawyers that could care less if you're dead or alive, or at the end of the trial, when you want to investigate and independently verify the information, nobody is willing to talk to you. So basically, I had one case recently, we tried to contact the family members, and the family is so afraid, A, because of the wiretapping, and they feel the government is listening to their conversation, and B, they feel embarrassed that their son was gay. So they say, oh, I don't want to talk about this issue. So there are so many layers of problems that makes it impossible for us to determine whether the justice has been served or not, or what was the real cause of the arrest.
I would like to go back, because we got sidetracked when you were speaking about the penalization of a lesbian relationship, if you can go back to that.
Oh, sure. Sorry. We started on a different track. And
it's
then.
Okay.
So, yeah. So in many countries, you have a milder punishment for lesbians. And there are theories about that. They say because it's a male-dominated society, so if a man turns out to be gay, so men are considered to be on the top of the hierarchy, and then you have the women, and then you have everything else. So you are a man that actually do not want to be a man, you want to be a woman, so you are downgraded. As a gay man, you are downgrading yourself, and that's like no, you know, so you should be punished. Now, a lesbian wants to sleep with another woman, she's not really downgraded because she's already a second-class citizen, so yeah, we'll do something, but not as serious. So that's one side of the story, the legal analysis of that. But then you have the reality that is the endless oppression of women. So I have interviewed people, they're lesbians and they don't want to get married to a straight man, but hey, who cares? You are a woman and your fate has already been decided, so you'd have to get married. It's not like you have a choice. There is a lot of honor killing that's going on, especially for women, that they do not even get reported to the authorities. And the police does not want to intervene. And that's not in a conservative society in Iran only. You have across the Middle East, that's very common. The woman is considered to be the honor and the property of the family. So you'd better behave yourself. If you don't, then you know where you're going to go. And the police does not want to intervene because they simply say, oh, it's a family business. It's not really our place to investigate it. So there is a lot of oppression like that that is happening under the surface, unreported, and undocumented, unfortunately. And people who are lesbians don't even know they have rights because they were told that A, as a good woman, you have to follow whatever the family wants to do, and B, you feel that, oh, I have urges, but you know what? I want to be like anybody else. And then the last part, which is extremely important, is financial dependence. As a man, it's easier always for you to walk away and find a job and a place. As a woman, you know, you are more prone to rape, you are more prone to exploitation, so you always have to rely on other people, especially if you are coming from an underprivileged background without an education.
Is it somehow easier for women to have secret relationships because of the way that society has structured, divided genders?
Strangely, yes, but again, it's a mixed blessing, because on the one hand, you know that you are considered to be the inferior being, you are the second class citizen because you are a woman, but at the same time, you are invisible. Because of your invisibility, you can walk away with things. And two women, they're like, oh, you know, and I've seen that in many countries, from Morocco to Iran, you know, to United Arab Emirates, you know, they do this. It is safer. However, is it dignified? I would say no. You don't want just to be a sexual being. You are a full human being. You are multidimensional. You want to be recognized as you are, and you can't be that. So yes, it's safer to have a secret romantic relationship with another woman, but you're always risking the fact that if you are exposed, you will be totally marginalized or even killed, and the fact that as a woman you don't have equal rights compared to men.
It is known around that the situation for transsexual people in Iran is in a way different, because if you choose to change your gender, then you pass as either man or woman. Can you explain this?
Sure. That's one of those cases that still you don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. And I guess it is in a way it is a blessing, because they at least they are not criminalized. What happened was that it all started with one person, a man who felt that he's in the wrong body, and he did not think about going to international community, writing a book about his story or anything. He just kept saying, oh, I want to be a woman. And then they said, oh, you're crazy. And then he says, well, but that's my urges, you know, this, that. So he tried for 5 or 6 years. And he tried to have a meeting with the highest ranking clergyman in Iran, tried to explain his situation. Prior to his case, there was no term as transgender in their vocabulary.
In the language.
In the language of the clergyman in Iran, and basically, even now, in many countries, it's still criminalized in the Middle East. They call them the third gender, and all sorts of stigma are attached to that. But what he did, he just kept going there. And then he started arguing with the top-ranking clergyman. He says, well, you said that I have to be who I have to follow my religious things. But listen, I'm a woman born in the male body. And if I hang out with other male people, then I'm exposing myself, even though my true nature is different. So he tried that argument, and it worked. So at the end of the conversation, the clergyman, issued, the top-ranking clergyman, issued a religious decree saying that he needs to do what he needs to do. And he said, as long as it is confirmed by the medical experts, meaning that he is indeed a transgender and needs to be surgically reassigned gender, that's fine. Since then, this plan has been implemented in Iran. There are thousands of people that have gone through gender reassignment. However, there is a trick part here. First thing is that as a transgender person, the only way that you can get out of your misery, if you like, because it is a really miserable situation while when you, the society start asking you questions and you have no way to answer, is that you are willing to become the go through the transgender reassignment basically process. Whether you like it or not, that is the only option that you have. And I've heard and talked to people who do not want to be surgically reassigned, but that's not an option for them. The second part is that the government does not do that because they care about the gender identity argument. They do that because they have a binary model. You're either a man or a woman. Now, there was a mistake in the creation and you're born in the wrong gender, so we'll fix you up. You see, it's a selfish motive for the government to fix the society and care about the morality of the people. And I've seen people that have suffered a lot because of this process. Plus, think about it. You are born as a man. So even though you feel that you are transgender, the society perceives you as a male, and as a male you have privileges. Then you decide that, oh, I'm not a man, I want to become a woman. Actually, these cases happen. They go through the surgical procedure. The government subsidizes the whole process because they want you to fix you up as soon as possible. Then you become a woman. What happens? First thing you realize that you are now a second-class citizen. Because there's no equality. So it's not that, okay, I changed my gender, now I feel better. No, now you're considered nothing. Then you have to cover your head everywhere you go. You have limits that you never had. And there have been cases that people decided to reverse the changes because they felt they can't live like that. So it is a mixed blessing, basically, when you talk about the transgender situation. The good part is that they are not criminalized. The bad part is that there is no human right perspective about their situation.
Can you speak about the region amply? Because, I mean, the picture that you have drawn from Iran is rather grim. Is the situation similar in the region? And also, I guess, in North Africa, since you also work with that area?
Well, unfortunately, the picture is grim and it's only getting grimmer. There are exceptions to that. There are hopeful exceptions to that. Countries like Lebanon, they happen to enjoy relative freedom. Lebanon is rather an exception. In Lebanon, you have a mosaic of ethnicity, religions, and ethnic backgrounds. It's a small country, but within that small country, you have a president. The president of the country is always a Christian. The prime minister is a Sunni Muslim, and then the speaker of the parliament is always a Shiite Muslim. That created a very interesting dynamics. People are politically and socially more active, and even though Lebanon has the sodomy law, there is a very vibrant LGBT movement. They are tolerated, they are not registered, but they are tolerated. They have allies within the government. A minister of health, for example, they have partnership with other international groups, and they have offices, you know, within visible presence, basically hotlines, social services, parties, everything in Beirut.
And bars and clubs and things like that.
There are bars and gay clubs. They are not run by the LGBT movement, but they are part of the community. Yes, they do exist. Yes, but that's rather an exception. Turkey is similar. Again, there is a debate whether you want to include Turkey as part of the Middle East. We did. It was my insistence that Turkey should be, because even though they're trying to join Europe, they're still, their religious background and their cultural background is relevant to the Middle East. You have no sodomy law in Turkey. You have multiple LGBT groups that are legally registered and active, but you have an extremely homophobic and transphobe society that basically operates in this society, and they don't tolerate gay people. There is huge discrimination against people that are considered to be gay, and the government unfortunately does not do anything to protect the LGBT community. There have been endless cases of murder, especially of transgender people, in the past few years. Systematic discrimination. You are not hired by employers if you're gay or transgender. In a country where sex work is legal, transgender people are not even allowed to engage in sex work. They are not allowed to do anything, including sex work, basically. So as you can imagine, it's very difficult for people to survive. So you enter into the social and economic justice argument for them. However, this society remains very involved. The civil society is active, and there are groups within the civil society that are defending the rights of LGBT people. There are a number of LGBT groups in Turkey that are active. Because Turkey wants to join the European Union, they pretend to be progressive. Sometimes that's good enough, you know. And there's a struggle going on. But unfortunately, in most other countries, you do not see any signals. They are all under the radar, very quiet sort of movements that are happening, mainly at individual levels, or people who are active outside the country but do not dare or cannot really do anything inside the country. So it's a very, very sort of like unsafe environment. Police states that are monitoring everything, your emails, your communications.
Do you consider Israel to be part of the Middle East?
It's not that I consider that. Yes, it is part of the Middle East, and Israel perhaps is an exception, except for the fact that there is always this sensitivity around the presence of LGBT groups from Israel. Because of the ongoing tension between Israelis and Palestinians, unfortunately, they have not been able to communicate with each other. So the Israeli groups have made that decision early on that they do not have that expectation to be included. I don't know if a peace treaty is going to solve that problem or not, to be honest with you. But as of now, you have a choice. You can either work with the Israeli groups or with the rest of the Middle Eastern LGBT communities. And most of our partners basically do not want to deal with Israeli groups. Part of it is political. If you are known to work with Israeli LGBT groups, you will be marginalized within the society. So in countries like Lebanon, that is a very vibrant civil society environment, having ties with Israel is the kiss of death, practically, because the two countries are still at war, so you can't really talk about that. And there are similar situations, and plus, you have to keep in mind the conspiracy theory. The conspiracy theory goes like this. Homosexuality is not an indigenous concept. It is a ploy by the Western governments and the Israelis in order to undermine the societies in the Middle East. You may think that's a crazy talk. Every day, I'm afraid, in one Arabic newspaper, at least, you see stories like this. Every day. So with that negative mindset that homosexuality is promoted by Israel, if an Arab LGBT group tries to contact an Israeli group, at the end of the day, the only thing that will be proven is the conspiracy theory that unfortunately exists. So there are so many problems that they have to be mindful of.
That reminds me of the communist movement saying that homosexuality was a product of capitalism.
Yes, yes, pretty much. It's the same. It's not us, it's somebody else. Now, the argument is, who is somebody else? But in that region, it's a very convenient way to blame everything, you know, on, oh, they did it, the Zionists did it. And the Zionists are also responsible for the homosexuality of our people. So yeah, it is a very tricky situation for people, activists on both sides.
You've outlined all the challenges of these communities in the Middle East. But one thing I don't have clear is what would be a strategic plan of action, because it seems like the situation is really stuck in the sense that you cannot change religious logic from one day to the other. How can you change? Is for example, an idea of a social movement forming something that could be possible at all?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I would say, as dark as the situation is, there is a growing movement. As I said, the problem is that in most countries in the Middle East, you don't have any open conversation about sexuality to begin with. People don't feel comfortable to talk about sexuality in general, the agency that people have over their own body. So you don't even get to the issue of homosexuality. And somehow that conversation should start somewhere. And I think this conversation is getting started. We're not there yet. But the fact that in the past decade you see that there is a growing number of groups that are either directly or indirectly talking about these issues. Even in countries like Iran, you see that the government, the very government whose president comes to New York and says there are no homosexuals in Iran, this year they started a program. They created a hotline for family crisis, including if somebody feels they're gay, so they offer counseling. So for the first time, you see that they are talking about homosexuality in a non-criminal language. Now, it's a medical approach, and it's not what we're looking for, but it's a step forward. You know, at least you're not being killed, you're not being targeted, you could be considered a vulnerable population, and they may try to put you in a shelter or something, some sort of support. It's not ideal again, but it's better than getting killed. The other part of the argument is the language. 10, 15 years ago, there was no word in Arabic or Persian that could describe the word homosexuality. You had all this negative language, negative lexicon that existed, basically, that people used to talk about homosexuality. In the past 10, 15 years, that landscape has changed. The groups, both outside the region and inside the region, have produced cultural literature that is addressing that language. So now you have positive words to talk about homosexuality. You have...
What is the word in Farsi?
So in Farsi, when I was growing up, for example, the politest thing you could find about homosexuals was the word Hamjins Baz, which is really a derogatory term. You think about Hamjins means same sex. Baz means like somebody who's chasing somebody else. So the connotation is like chasing women, like you have a womanizer. Now for homosexuals, a manizer. It's just a very negative sexualizing thing. And that was the politest thing you could say about thing. Now you have the word Hamjins Gera, which literally means oriented towards members of the same sex. It does not have that chasing factor, and that, you know, you're like a horny being, you just want to have sex. That is taken out. And there are also other vocabulary to talks about transgender and also about lesbians, and all of that have been coined. The same thing in Arabic. You had Shad Jinsi, you know, in Arabic they used to say, which literally means that sexually unnatural, and that was again the politest thing you could say. In Iraq they used to call the son of a bitch. Oh, that was even better compared to other things that I heard, and so on and so forth. And now that you have the word mithli, which literally means interested in the same gender, you know, so that positive language, and also the fact that you see in the past few years less and less mainstream media are talking about killing gay people and still talk about curing them. Again, that's not where you want to be, but if you have a vulnerable population that have nowhere to turn, I would say that it's good, better for them to live in a society where people want to treat them and then kill them. There have been sort of cultural movement that have been happening, plus the fact that civil society is gaining support for sexual minorities. You see that in Jordan, you see that in Lebanon, you see that in Morocco, you see that in even to some extent like in Turkey, you know, you see similar movements. So there are different countries that are trying to basically negotiate the space for the LGBT movement. Now, it is a century behind where we are right now in the United States, but you have to start somewhere.